Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And we're bringing you information today about things that are... It's just so nice the marathon's over and we get a chance to be with you again. In the studio with me today, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. Kent, welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be here.
We wanted to bring you something special today because of some of the more recent research on men and depression. Yes, we're learning more and more about men and men being depressed. You know, depression is sometimes called the common cold of mental health. But, you know, it's not like a common cold because it doesn't go away in a week without treatment. And it doesn't affect men and women equally or in the same way, the way a cold does. Although a lot of attention's been paid at it, at every age, well, no, that's not true. Women are more depressed during their childbearing years. From puberty to menopause, there is a higher incidence of depression in women than there is in men. So we want to understand that. We're not even sure if that's exactly true. It may be just what we're calling depression. We're going to be getting into that quite a bit. However, on the other hand, men have a worse health than women, worse health than women at every age, and a higher death rate. That no matter what age you are, if you're 15-year-old women are healthier than 15-year-old boys. 30-year-old women are healthier than 30-year-old boys. It's like this, so now wait a minute. Women get more depressed and men are sicker. Let's look even a step further.
Yeah, I mean, it's even before birth. I mean, there are more, infants or fetuses that don't come full term. So this kind of propensity towards illness and death and sickness medically in males goes from conception right to the grave throughout the whole life cycle in terms of medical problems.
How about psychiatric disturbances other than depression?
Other than depression, other sorts of psychiatric disorders like schizophrenia, in fact, males have a higher incidence than females. Certainly an area I'm very interested in, substance abuse and addiction, as you can imagine, alcoholism, substance abuse, again, much, much more prevalent amongst males than females. A lot of childhood illnesses, conduct disorder, adolescent sort of antisocial behavior, juvenile delinquency, as you can imagine, much more prominent in males than females. The cousin of depression, which is manic depression, bipolar disorder, where there is depression that looks like and is very similar to depression, but it's admixed with mania symptoms of irritability or grandiosity or other kinds of symptoms, that's equal in men and women. There's no difference between men and women in the incident of that. But depression and anxiety is reported to be much more prevalent in women, and certainly women go to treatment much more readily for depression and anxiety than men.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. We're talking about the difference between men and women. Not the difference so much. We want to talk about male depression specifically today. Now, the most important clue to understanding the gender difference in depression is that women are, like we said, women are more susceptible during their childbearing years. How do you interpret that clue? You know, what does that mean? One theory is that women are more vulnerable to depression because they have problematic interactions between the stress hormones and reproductive hormones. That's what they're saying. They're saying that the stress hormones have a funny kind of reaction to the reproductive hormones, and they cause depression. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, I think what we know is that the female hormone, the woman's hormone of estrogen, seems to be linked with depression and anxiety. If you have too much female hormone of estrogen, obviously this goes throughout the life cycle and the menstrual cycle, it is known to be contributing to feelings of depression and anxiety. The men's hormone, which is testosterone, seems to be somewhat protective, and higher rates of testosterone in men seem to make men feel better and be less depressed. And studies that we may talk about where they give testosterone to women can sometimes raise their mood. So it seems like the female hormone estrogen is related to depression, and the male hormone testosterone seems to be protective of depression.
And is it related to psychosis and and a lot of other illnesses. So here we are, my friends, and we're not just talking about the fact, the same old story, you know, women get more depressed than men do. That's not what we care about. What we care about is what we're seeing in men, which is a tremendous incidence of depression that is hidden. But let's just talk about it for a moment, some of the experiments I've seen. Some of the experiments, they would take a mouse and they would have a mouse run a track. And they would have the mouse running a task, and the mouse, after trying to find an exit one way or another, couldn't find the exit, eventually would give up and quit. That would make sense. You go for many doors. Quit and lay down and stop moving. But if they found out, if they give the mouse a medication, antidepressant medication, he doesn't quit as fast, or she doesn't quit as fast. If you give him testosterone, he doesn't quit. But if you give him progesterone, if you give him the female hormone, they tend to quit earlier. So therefore, this whole idea of getting exhausted and getting fatigued and quitting is kind of linked with female hormones and not with male hormones. So it's like a funny thing. Is depression therefore some kind of quitting? Well, we took a further look at that. And a low rate of depression in men may very well be an illusion. This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. We're talking in The Positive Mind about male depression. See, we know that men don't like to admit, even to themselves, that they are depressed. They may feel that it's weak or unmanly, and they show despair, to show despair or self-doubt. You talk to a man, and I've talked to men I know who are good friends. How are you doing? Fine. And you can see they're a wreck. You can see, oh, there's something troubling you. No, it's all right. I'll take care of it. You know, I'll handle it. I'm not going to talk about it. Sometimes I wonder if what a man really does by doing that is he segments his worries, puts them in a part of his brain that he's afraid they're going to become real if he talks about them. And so he just pushes them away. It's not that he's denying his friend seeing his weakness. It's that he'll feel his weakness if he talks about it, you see? So he doesn't want to talk about it. So women very often will say to men, talk to me about what you've got going on, and men will shut them off. They're not shutting them off because they don't want to talk to the women. They don't want to air it out. They don't want to let it out, because if you give it some air, then maybe it's going to feel more. So one thing we have about men is that they don't talk about it. They could feel weak or unmanly. They could show despair or self-doubt. So they fear what might happen if their colleagues find out about their depression or their employers. So they withdraw into a quiet misery and develop a male depression syndrome. Now get this, male depression, how does it appear? Well, you can see the guy who's very dark and stays at home, and he's kind of moody, and he walks around moody. That's one, but that's not very good. You're not masquerading it, you know? Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, you know, on Halloween, we used to have a Halloween party when I was in training, Kent. This is completely off the subject. Go as your neurosis. Go as your neurosis, or make up, pick up something out of the DSM and become that thing. Happy Halloween to everybody out there. So men who want to hide their depression very often can't do it if they're truly depressed and the depression takes them over. If that mood slides over you and you just can't pick up your head, you're not hiding your depression. Everybody sees it. So you look dark and you look not so good. But men have another way of doing it. They have a way of hiding their depression through a kind of male depression syndrome, which masquerades as anger, irritability, alcoholism, or drug abuse. And because they don't seek treatment, their depression is never diagnosed and never recorded. And because it's never diagnosed and not recorded and they don't seek treatment, we assume men have less depression than women.
Right. I think, again, a lot of people would feel that when we're talking about the different incidents of depression in men and women, that maybe women are just more able to communicate and talk about their feelings. They're, you know, that's an archetypical feminine and important female feature, which is to talk about your emotional world, to interact with others emotionally. Men are doers. You know, men are taught to do things.
Well, historically, that's how men are perceived.
Yeah.
But I don't think men are really doers. I mean, what you're saying is the general role that is attributed to men is to be. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. That again, for generations and generations, the stereotypical male, female, masculine, feminine trait is that men do, women talk and nurture. Now, clearly in 2006, when we have male therapists, Armand DeMille and Kent Robertshaw, hopefully nurturing, hopefully connected with their emotions, and hopefully good at being comforting and nurturing to people around them. And we have Hillary Clinton, and we have women who are very successful, very confident, very much doing things in the world. So I think that there's a total breakdown into any kind of stereotype about what is masculine and what is feminine. And now there's more freedom to have a good yin and yang kind of mixture of those quote-unquote traits.
So I'm on the move, Kent Rabbit, sure. So if people don't have, if men are depressed but they're not relating it, they may not even be aware of it. Men are much less in tune with their bodies than women are.
Well, certainly they're very likely to manifest their depression and self-medicate their depression by, you know, taking alcohol or drugs or something, so that they're distracted, let's say, by work during the day. So work maybe gives them some, you know, sort of momentary relief. But then in their unguarded time, during their evenings and night, if this uncomfortable feeling that they're not connected to, because when you're saying about men compartmentalizing these emotions, I tend to find that they're not able to do it very well. That if there is something that's very sad or very anxious going on in their head, it comes out in some way. It comes out as an irritability in terms of hurt people. So the depressed feeling comes out in a kind of wish to lash out at others, you know, misery loves company. Or it's sort of, you know, done with some kind of addiction, some kind of running away, you know, compulsively shopping, compulsively, you know, buying things on eBay or starting to drink or use drugs as a way to masking the depression and anxiety.
So what you're saying, Kent, and I think I'm saying, and I think we're maybe saying for the first time, is that for men, let's just say if there's a testosterone, if there's low male functioning, medium male functioning, and super male functioning, normal male functioning may be to have a normal amount of aggression, a normal amount of get-to-itness, but the super maleness is in itself a form of depression that we don't see because we can't see it because it just looks too masculine. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, is he depressed? Well, you know, it's a funny thing. If you look up close, he seems depressed. Mm-hmm. And so do all of the superheroes. You know, all of the men that you see who play these superhero roles and these physical roles and these, you know, these muscle men, if you listen to them, you could hear the depression somewhere in there. But it's masked by the bulging muscles and the activity.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the traits that everyone finds admirable in men and women, but is, again, associated with masculine stereotype, would be things like self-confidence, self-reliance, self-assertion, a degree of aggressiveness and assertiveness, maybe a better word, and a healthy sense of competition and being competitive. Now, clearly, we all know that if someone's self-confidence, if they're overly dependent, they're shy, they're withdrawn, they're not taking risks, they let people walk all over them, and they shy away from any kind of interaction, that seems to be somebody depressed and somebody not functioning well. But as you're bringing up, the other side of it, which is overly confident can get people acting cocky, you know, and arrogant. And that isn't necessarily healthy, and that can be a cover for their low self-esteem. And certainly the trait of self-reliance can get people overly dependent on themselves, maybe to the detriment of having relationships and friendships. And certainly a lot of men, really they rely on their wives and the women in their lives to be the social directors. And certainly the number of people I talk to when they call their parents' house, you know, the mother gets on the phone and talks for a half hour, and dad is kind of monosyllabic, barely says anything, maybe about the Giants winning on Sunday, and seems to be just very much in his own world, very much a loner, you know, very disconnected to lots of people, not many friends, let's say, but even not very connected to his own children. Again, this self-reliance taken to an extreme of isolation and loneliness. And clearly the other things about being assertive, aggression, and competitive, as you can tell, that can really go awry as people become driven rather than just not assertive. And the aggressiveness can be that they like to dominate people. They're, you know, like the stereotypical boss, you know, who gets off on being aggressive and making others feel small. It's not just a healthy assertiveness, but a wish to dominate and control other people.
And we're saying that that's depression.
Yeah, I think that,
you
again,
see, that there it is right there. They don't look depressed, but it is depressed. And if you took that hyper-aggressive person, and instead of treating them as if they're hyper-aggressive and we want to slow them down and give them a tranquilizer, I bet if you treated them with antidepressants, they may respond just as well.
Yeah, that some of the, you know, again, if their healthy sense of feeling good about themselves and feeling trusting of the world around them is better in balance, they won't have to be so cocky and so driven and so competitive to a fault, because they're trying to compensate for this feeling of insecurity and inferiority that may be underneath this overly, you know, over masculine, you know, sort of reaction. If in fact they're feeling better about themselves, obviously Kohut and talking about self-psychology talks quite a bit about this, that this compensation for low self-esteem by arrogance, cockiness, drivenness, and the like. And certainly a certain degree of self-reliance and being a loner, underneath that is sometimes some mild distrust and paranoia of
people. Now that brings us to another thing about the relationship that most men lack with a trusting, nurturing father. They have dads who meet them on the hormonal testosteronic playing field. I'm proud of your son. You really went to war. And I'm really glad you knocked off those Iraqis. You know, there's that guy. Or I'm glad you scored that home run. You know, you got to do a little better in school. That's one meeting. And then there's the other dad. The dad who looks at you, who hugs you, who says, whatever you want, kid, I love you. Mm-hmm. Now, that's so rare that what I find is when a man comes to see me, to consult with me, and he sees that I'm not going to judge him, and I'm not going to meet him on that male-male level, and yet I'm not going to be showing him any weakness, and I'm not going to be looking at his weakness. When they see it, they melt. Men find such refuge in finding someone who is, they would consider to be at least equal to them as a man, and yet has the tenderness to accept them. It's such a thing. It's so important. So I tend to treat more men than I do women. I mean, and it's rare. It's unusual. Men are attracted to, you know, wanting to see me and speak to me because they don't feel safe in this world. And they don't have models of it. They usually don't have families. And I think there's quite a correlation between family problems and male depression. Now, what is the correlation? Male depression specifically, almost never, a man almost never has a good relationship with his father. Is that true among the depressed men?
Well, I think that there's usually certainly one or both parents, that there's both relationships that have not been very satisfying, very nurturing, very loving, very much sort of reinforcing the person being connected to their emotional world, as well as many, you know, one or both parents where there is depression in one or both of the parents. So the the generational, one after another generation of depression. And a lot of people, again, as we're talking about, the father may be depressed, but the father isn't weeping and isn't sad and morose. He just may be snarky and grumpy, and or he's drinking 3 to 5 scotches every night. And that father is the depressed parent that is somehow giving a role modeling or modeling to the son as the normal way of being, which is sort of grumpy, negative, pessimistic, giving up. As well as, I think, a more complicated thing about children of depressed parents, which has to do with the fact that we're all very egocentric until we're 7 years old. There's still patients of mine who are 47 very egocentric, but certainly we're all, until 7 or 8, think the whole world around us revolves around us. So everything that happens to us. So a child also seems to understand the depression in mom and dad is due to the fact that I'm not good enough. Meaning if they were happy with me, if they were proud of me, they would be happier. They don't understand about marital problems, financial problems, or anything like that. A 7 and 8-year-old only understands when I look up at mommy and daddy's face and it looks grumpy or anxious or blue that they're not happy with me. So maybe I have bad breath, maybe I'm not getting good enough grades, maybe my penis isn't big enough, maybe I'm the wrong gender. I don't know what it is, but it's something about me, and that can leave a lingering feeling that there's something unlovable about me or something not good enough about me. Guilt and shame, very powerful features of depression, feeling lesser than or feeling like I'm a bad person, a bad friend, bad son, bad brother, bad boyfriend, bad husband.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult for a child to grow up with a depressed parent. Parents don't, they hide their depression, they try their best, they don't seek treatment. So then they grow up, they bring up a child who's either acting out, meaning a troubled child, or a depressed child. And so what they do is they bring the child for treatment. Mm-hmm. But what we're saying here is that in almost every case, when there is a depressed child or an acting out child, there's depression in the family. And the real treatment should go to the family. Now, I can't tell you the number of times I've treated parents rather than children. And when parents say to me, what do I do for my child? I say, get yourself better. Get yourself better, get yourself undepressed, and watch how your child changes. Rather than giving these medications to kids and having the kids take the medications because the parents don't want to look at themselves, very often one of the ways we can help a child who is depressed is to treat the depressed parent. The depressed parent will often say, I'm depressed because my child is so upset. And so if you just fix the child, I'll feel better. And it's usually not the case.
Yeah, I think that it's just not even childhood depression. I mean, even things like ADD and a hyperactive child, and as you said, a kind of an acting out child who's aggressive or is causing trouble and with teachers and oppositional and defiant, that a lot of those children are reacting to a household that there isn't a degree of good feelings, warm, loving faces on mommy and daddy's face that provides a kind of soil, you know, a kind of nutrient for the soil for them to grow up feeling strong and healthy and safe. You know, that the depression or the marital fighting, both of which obviously rather negative for the environment that they're in, causing the child to, to be depressed, anxious, or to be unable to focus because the reason they're not focused is perhaps not because they have some chemical ADD, but they have all these trouble emotions that are percolating around in their head that are making it hard for them to pay attention to things.
Well, Ken, let me ask you something. If a man comes to you and he's got these two symptoms, they're two such common symptoms. There are men I know who are all up in their brain and they're just so obsessional. All they could do is think about their problems. That's one form of man. He's worried about the future and he's depressed. Another form of guy, a depression, is a guy who's depressed and he talks about the regrets from the past. Mm. He talks about the past, and if only I had done this, if I had only bought that house, I'd now be a millionaire. And is there a difference between those two kind of depressions, the one who's forward-looking and the one who's backward-looking?
Well, certainly the first one is very common with male depression, which is, again, a very much, you know, Mr. Spock from Star Trek, very much in the head, very much cut off from what he is feeling, but and very much trying to think about ways to solve the feeling that something's not right, that they're feeling, again, negative. They're feeling negative in their life in some way. Negative would be the world around me is not good enough. I'm dissatisfied. I'm dissatisfied with who I see in the mirror. I'm dissatisfied with my career. I'm dissatisfied with this house. I'm dissatisfied with my body. I'm basically dissatisfied and feeling lesser than. And trying to then think of something to fix that, and perhaps getting away from, well, maybe something hurts emotionally. You know, maybe this feeling of dissatisfaction that you're blue or sad about something.
So this thinking over and over again of finding a solution.
Right.
I'll find a solution, I'll find a solution, I'll find a solution, I'll find a solution. We call that obsessive thought.
Right.
And we have obsessive thought mixed with a mood of not feeling good. Then we have a mood of not feeling so good mixed with a feeling of regrets. And I find that those are two distinct kinds of depression, even though I don't know if they have different words. What do you call the one that's filled with regrets versus the one that's filled with obsessional thoughts about the future?
I think they tend to have more of an admixture of worry when they're focused about the future. Because, again, so much is tied up into this feeling that only if something happens down the road, I will feel better.
But do we have a name for that?
Well, again, I think a lot of worrying is associated with that feeling of depression because there's a worry that, in fact, these things in the future are not going to play.
But we don't have a thing called a worry depression.
I think
versus the regret depression.
Yeah, I would think that the anxious depression would be the name I would give to the first one where there's all this anxiety. And the obsessional depression would be the one where there's many, you know, thoughts about the girlfriend I should have stayed with, the job I should have bought Yahoo at 10 cents and all those sorts of past regrets. So that has more of an obsessional component to the depression as opposed to the anxious, worried depression where a lot of the focus is towards the future. And again, a lot of feelings of negativity, a lot of feelings of hopelessness about trying to be happier in the future. But clearly those people, I find often they have enough going on today in their day to be happy, meaning that if people are in a good place psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, where they are is okay, unless you're in Abu Ghraib or in Sloan Kettering, you know, that where you are is just fine for most people. But
so there's somebody else walking right next to you
who's
feeling good with the same situation you have, and you're feeling bad in the same situation. You can have identical life situations, identical incomes. One guy feels okay, the other guy's upset.
Oh, I always tell my patients that if we went to Darfur or, you know, one third of the world goes to bed hungry, and the number of people, the number of men, again, in terms of their competitiveness that we talked about and their aggressiveness, there's so much linked to their depression that they're Willie Loman, right? They're from, you know, Death of a Salesman, that they haven't achieved enough, you know, because I'm not Donald Trump, because I'm not, you know, LeBron James, because I'm not, you know, some kind of super success, I feel lesser than. Those people must be very happy and feel successful. And I swear that one third of the world, if they looked at Americans and they looked at how lucky we are, the education and the resources, they couldn't understand in the New York area, which tends to attract so many successful people, it's surprising how many of those feel depressed.
And when we get back, we're going to be taking your calls today. But you see, no matter where you are, if you're depressed, you're depressed. It doesn't matter how big your benefits are, how beautiful your wife is, how big your house is, how much money you have. Depression is going to make you run down no matter what you have. So just the comparing yourself to, you know, children in China are starving doesn't really help very much. It doesn't make you feel much better. We're going to be back with you in a couple of minutes. When we come back, I'll play you some new special music, and then we'll take your telephone calls about male depression. This is Armand DeMille, right back with you. Steady Eddie by Bill Ware, W-A-R-E, vibraphone, with Ed Rodriguez on drums and Brad Jones on bass. Very, very sweet. And a listener of WBAI sent us this album saying, hey, look at what you got. It's on an album called Vibes, V-I-B-E-S, Withdraw, Vibes Withdraw. Nice, withdrawn. Steady Eddie, Bill Ware. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you at the Positive Mind with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. We're looking at male depression. Why male depression? Because there's a tendency to not look at male depression because men are so good at hiding depression from themselves and from others, because that's the way it is. I mean, the way it is in nature. You don't walk around if you're wounded. You don't show your wounds because the other animal's going to jump on you and eat you up. So you hide it. So if you got a broken leg, you try to walk as if you don't need it. You know, and that's the way men tend to be. It's the way that it was born into you. That's your instinct to survive. On the other hand, there's a lot of misery out there in men, and depression is characterized by just terrible things. I mean, sleeplessness is often a sign. Give us some of the signs, Kent. Robert Shaw.
Yeah, the kinds of things you're looking for is it often affects your sleep. You're not sleeping well, or paradoxically, you're oversleeping. You need to sleep all the time. It affects your appetite. You're either overeating or your appetite is gone. Your energy level is down. You get tired throughout the day. You get fatigued in the middle of activities, and even in the middle of enjoyable activities, you feel yourself getting slowed down. Your concentration is off. Your thinking is off. And clearly there's a sense that something's wrong with you, some pervasive sense that you're ugly, you're stupid, you're a loser, people don't like you, you have nothing interesting to say. All these kind of negative perceptions of yourself is a big part of depression. You're often looking the world around you in terms of the triad of negativity, and everything around you is not making you very happy. And as we were saying before, depressed people often look towards the future with a great sense of just, you know, dark colored glasses, you know, and that things are going to get worse and things are only going to be more trouble and more misfortune and more failure, often linking to their sense that they're a failure and around the corner and soon there's going to be more disappointment and failure.
On the other hand, the other side of depression is not seeing the depression at all, not feeling the failure, but feeling like a victim of the world, feeling angry, feeling frustrated, feeling drug addicted, you know, feeling like, you know, having a shot of alcohol is the only thing that's going to help you, resentments, just a general negativity. So the one thing we know about depression, the word is negative. Negative, one way or another. Either you're going to be talking bad about yourself, or you're going to be talking overly good about yourself and be talking bad about people. So if someone comes into my office and I hear them bad-mouthing themselves or the rest of the world, I say depressed. And so when we look at depression, we want to see where it is, how we're going to touch it. Another major symptom of depression is a reduced sexuality. Women, have you worried why? How come your husband is no longer interested? Well, the very reason you ask yourself, why is my husband not interested? The man is asking himself, I wish I could feel more interested. But he's losing his libido. He's losing it. And that's part of depression. He may be able to bring it up for something new that comes along. He may, if a spark came along, if he got a massage or something, or he saw something entertaining, or pornography, might stimulate him for a moment. But in general, he's losing his sexuality. Now, there's a double-sided sword here, because if a man is depressed and he's losing his sexuality, it's like one of the great signs of manhood. Who could he talk to about this? Who does he call up? Does he call up his friend and he say to his friend, gee, you know, I can no longer get an erection. I don't know what's wrong with me. Well, a lot of men who feel secure in themselves will talk about it just that way. But if a man feels insecure, he's never going to discuss that. And that's the kind of guy who becomes dangerous. You know, you talk about all the acting out crazy guys. A lot of them just have diminished sexual capacity. And it's one of the ways that they take it out. And then on top of that, a man may go to therapy, or he may go for treatment for his depression, and he gets an antidepressant. Now, here we run into another problem. Because if he takes an antidepressant to feel less depressed, the odds are the antidepressant itself is going to make him even more sexless. Men and women, isn't that true, Kenneth?
Yeah, both men and women. These new medication, these antidepressants called serotonergic reuptake inhibitors, they, in over 50% of people, seem to decrease libido and sexual drive and craving for sexual pleasure, and certainly in men and women, decrease sexual performance. So at least 50%, I think it's even higher than that. That's what the drug companies will tell us, but I think it's, in my own clinical practice, it must be 65-70% will report it, particularly as the dosage gets high. So it becomes more problematic as you're pushing those doses of Prozac, Paxil, Lexapro, up into the higher range.
So you walk in with a symptom of depression, which is called anhedonia. Nothing feels good. There is no pleasure. And then you take an antidepressant, and the one thing that used to feel good is you used to masturbate, touch, read, and you lose interest in that. So there's a depression underneath a depression. Now, the skilled physician who's treating you, if they're treating you with medicine, they'll adjust for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, we're talking about the fact that a lot of people who are on these medication may notice that maybe their mood in some aspect of their life is a little bit lighter, a little bit brighter, but it has come with a cost with their sexual libido and their ability to have an orgasm, their ability to perform sexually has been decreased. And because it's such a shameful area for both men and women, it's something they may not tell their therapist or tell their doctor. And it's very essential. It's essential for all the therapists and doctors to ask because it's so shameful that people may not volunteer it. But I think it's also up to the people to sort of feel comfortable enough because there is hope. You can often lower the medication or you can add on certain other medications that don't have this sexual side effect like Wellbutrin and Trazodone and Remerin, other kinds of categories that can sometimes work with the antidepressant or replace the antidepressant that's causing the side effects.
And even if you don't do medication, of course, the real help with the depression, if you could afford it, mm-hmm. is the psychotherapy. Because if you could do it through talking, they found it's just as effective as all medication. So if you could approach it without medication, that's great. But if you're stuck in the dumps and you have no way out and you're living a miserable life and you've got kids at home and those kids are living a miserable life because you feel miserable, I say take a pill. If you can't do anything else, if you've tried nutrition and you tried therapy and you tried finding friends and you tried beating up the neighbor next door and none of it worked, take a pill. Mm. Find a way so that you could bring your mood up and then work to make yourself better so that you could get yourself off the medication and live life a normal way, inspiring positivity around you, bringing positivity to your family, to the people that you live with. Everybody wants to be loved, including your family. You know? So a lot of men, they decide they're not going to get into a relationship. I found men who are chronic loners to be the kind of people who would not want to be in a relationship with anybody because they're afraid they're going to be discovered and they'd rather just be alone. Leave me alone. I'll stay in my house by myself. You know, leave me alone. I'll just I'll watch TV. Or leave me alone. I'll just go out and have casual dates and I'll sleep with somebody different every night. And that's okay if that's the way you want to go. If it doesn't affect yourself, it doesn't affect the work you do, it doesn't affect your health, fine. If it doesn't affect the people around you, that's a choice. But I say if it is affecting people around you and affecting your work and affecting your efficiency and affecting your role in this world as a positive force, do something about it. This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shore. I'm sure we have many questions about it. So I want to go to the phones, 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. I want to take your calls about this, about testosterone, about depression, about men, and about men who are depressed. Did you grow up with a depressed father? You know, now that you think about it, you know, you people out there, think about your dads. I'll make you a bet if we asked you if your father was depressed, more people would say yes than they would say no.
Yeah, people feeling that their father was just not a very happy or warm influence in their life. You know, maybe it's the lack of joy and the lack of warmth. There may not have been, again, tears or breaking things, but certainly a kind of, nothingness, a dullness.
A kind of nothingness is right.
You know, he brought home the bacon, brought the money, he took people to places, you know, he did things, but as in terms of a joyful, happy force, or as somebody who seemed to want to talk about what people were feeling. Again, a lot of people would say that their fathers never talked to them about what's going on, their disappointments in life. For example, love, you know, that many people, male and female, they wouldn't think of talking to their father about some relationship, some love relationship going sour. That mom is the person who wants to talk about how you feel and how to feel better with it. And the men are like, you know, talking to somebody about nuclear fission or something. They're fish out of waters. They don't even know how to start engaging in that kind of emotional current even in their children, let alone, as you can imagine, people with their friends have such a difficult time doing this. Now, just because my interest is substance abuse, I think many men, because of their shame and their shaming of their emotions, after about 2 to 5 or 12 to 15 drinks, that part of them that's scared about their emotional world, and dare I say scared to get close to another male emotionally, goes away. And a lot of men at 1 o'clock in the morning with a few drinks can talk about their feelings with other men the way women can at 12:30 in the afternoon with someone they just met in line at Duane Reade.
That's why I like the 7-step programs, because it gives a man a chance from being somebody who could only express himself when he was on some kind of an alcohol or a substance. He could go to an Al-Anon, Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and speak from his heart, and it's accepted.
Mm-hmm.
It's accepted and welcome. 212-209-2900. Let's take a couple of calls. We're back with you. This is Armand DeMille, Positive Mind, WBAI. Take a call right now. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I just have to think of circumcision, one of the detriments to man of all mankind all over the world. And I thought possibly you would talk about that particular issue attributing to depression.
Well, let me ask you something. You're talking about circumcision specifically.
Absolutely.
Yeah, now, in your life, did you have support from your father?
Well, somewhat.
And what was missing?
Time frame. More time.
He wasn't there enough.
No, and there were 8 children, and he was somewhat abusive and frustrated.
Yeah, he was abusive, and he was frustrated, and he was like somebody who was, you know, in his own life, he was symbolically circumcised.
Well, I will agree with that, but he wasn't. He was the whole.
And so you think what they did to you was unfair?
Well, absolutely. It is unfair. They made the wrong decision. These people, parents that make this decision for a man, is absolutely horrible.
And you felt it was horrible to you. What do you think it did to you?
I think it did what I would believe to be not capable of being in the physical workplace because the education wasn't there for me.
No, let me take that back. I'm sure you're saying what I want, but I can't understand it.
Yes, sir.
Your being circumcised, you believe, affected you negatively.
Absolutely.
And how did it affect you negatively? Your attitude towards yourself, in the world, you think is, you feel less because you were circumcised? And you think that men in general feel this, but just asking you personally.
Yes, I do feel that way, absolutely, only because I'm just not capable of going out and working like a physical type, construction type job. My strength has been robbed.
How about your sexuality?
I'm sorry, what about
that? How about your sexuality? Was that robbed as
well? I wouldn't know because I'm not an uncircumcised man, but from what I've read and what I believe, there is a tremendous difference. I was able to father 3 children. I can accommodate. Every man is different, of course, whether they're circumcised or not.
Oh, so you're not circumcised, but you think men who are circumcised?
No, I am. I am.
I thought you said you weren't.
No, I'm sorry. They got me.
Yeah, they got you, and it really robbed you of many things.
I believe. I think.
And so you're angry at your parents.
Well, the anger, I've forgiven them, really. But
you know, that's a difficulty, you know, being angry at people and forgiving them. It very often will make you feel terrible about yourself in life. Not that you shouldn't forgive them, but sometimes you've got to explore that anger a little more. But I thank you for bringing it up. I wonder how big an issue that is, because there are many people who have talked about circumcision.
Well, aside from alcohol, I think it's the largest, one of the largest issues.
Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you so much.
Right. Bye. All right. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Yes, there are many interesting things here. 212, I haven't read any long-term studies on this yet, but I know that just the thought of it is very often makes people just feel like, you know, how could you do that to a kid? 212-209-2900, let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Doc. Thank you for the call. Tell us what agitated depression is.
Now, your voice is kind of moving in and out. You must be on a cell phone. Is that true?
Yes, I'm on a mobile.
You're on a mobile phone. So, you know, I could hear almost every other word.
Could you call depression?
No, I can't hear it. Michael, we're going to have to go on to the next one because it's every other word I'm hearing. If you could call back from another line, I promise I'll take it. Or if I can't get your call today, feel free to call me at my office, and I'm willing to spend 2 minutes talking to anybody about anything you need. 212-757-4488, if you can't get through on these calls. Kent Robert Shore also is willing to talk to you. 212-209-2900 is the number here. We're taking your calls. Let's take another call. We're talking about male depression.
Good afternoon, Armand.
Hi there.
I'm all right. I don't really suffer from depression, but, however, my wife has been diagnosed with clinical depression a couple of years back. And her libido, I mean, I definitely found out that, you know, she wasn't very sexual. And I found that it's been sort of a problem because I was promiscuous at one point. I'm not anymore, but I do look at other women and, you know, and wonder.
I can see that you do, but you're saying you're not depressed, yet here you are with a wife who is depressed, and you're not able to have very much sex with her, so your life sounds pretty miserable.
Well, I want to say miserable, but let's just say that...
happy. You're okay. Not unhappy, but you're not happy.
Right. We engage in sexual intercourse about maybe once, twice a week. I would assume that's normal, or I don't know. Maybe I consider it less. I don't know if it's because of the
media. If you had it your way, you would be much more active.
Right.
So you feel a little frustrated and a little disappointed, and you wouldn't call it depression. Do you have kids?
Yeah, we have a 3-year-old girl.
Does your 3-year-old girl sense that there's a tension between you and your wife?
At times, yes. Yes, at times I'd say so.
Yeah. Did you ever wish you could just shield her from all of that?
Yes.
Yeah, I understand.
Definitely. I mean, I used to suffer from an anxiety when I was a teenager, and the way I dealt with that was through masturbation. And now I realize that it was anxiety because I did it constantly.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people think, you know, they take masturbation and they bring it into sexual relationships, and very often having sex with somebody is like masturbating. Like if you have a wife who's depressed and doesn't feel like having sex and doesn't have a libido, she becomes a good partner because in effect you can masturbate with her. You could in effect use her body for the very same thing. There is something about kind of making it a little richer experience that maybe is possible if you kind of checked into it a little further. Have you and she ever talked to a counselor about it?
No, but the thought has crossed my mind.
Not a bad idea. That's the kind of thing where if you went to a counselor, you might find there are certain buttons that could be pushed that could make it a richer experience for both of you.
Right. Now, as far as, I don't know what you'd say, I kind of talked her into stop taking the, you know, serotonin reuptake inhibitor.
That's right.
I talked her into stop taking it because I've read somewhere that, you know, that sometimes it can lead into even a worse depression if they continue to take it for long periods of time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, right. Usually I would want to do that with some kind of very conscious, you know, somebody like Kent Robert Shaw here would probably have a better way of looking at that. I'm not so sure that it's the best thing to do to just pull somebody off of medication. You might want to consult with an honest psychiatrist, which is not an oxymoron.
And my last question, is there a natural or a homeopathic way of dealing with depression?
There are many, and I think they're all worth trying. You know, they're all worth trying. But we've got to get going, and of course there is psychotherapy and talk therapy, which is the most natural way of doing it. I got to get going. I'm sorry I have to be going. We're out of time. This is okay. Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shore, the name of the show, The Positive Mind, the music Bill Ware. We are going to be back with you tomorrow at exactly 1 p.m., my friends. If you want a copy of today's program, if you want to hear today's program, you can go to the website, thepositivemind.com. Back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m.